Ironically, it was out at Croydon Park, where those neat little terraces of houses and parks now sit in Merino, that the Irish Citizens Army drilled. By March 1914, Larkin, Jack White and Constance Markovich revived the army, organising uniforms and weapons. The previous winter, largely as a reaction to the formation of the Ulster Volunteers under Edward Carson, the Irish Volunteers had been formed, with Owen McNeill as the leader.
That sense of different currents, of different impulses, of a grassroots activism, of a growing militancy at that level. Yeats in 1913 said that Ireland was like plastic, that it was ready to be moulded, and that it was going to remain plastic for a number of years to come. And again, you get this idea that there are opportunities for a variety of different movements to try and put their imprint on the kind of Ireland that they wanted to see.
Dermot Ferreter there. And to add to the militarism, by April, Come in the Morn is born, a women's brigade allied to McNeill's Irish Volunteers, and it largely replaces Inid na Héireann. Constant Markovich's Boy Scouts in na Fianna Éireann provide a training ground for the volunteers, and now Inid na Héireann becomes a fully formed woman's army, as Maud Gonne describes in this interview from the 1950s.
When Constance Markovich joined in Inid na Héireann, she undertook to drill our boys' classes. And eventually she founded Tiana na Héireann. Finally, Come in the Morn was founded in our offices in Harcourt Street. And the first branch was called after us, the Inidia branch of Come in the Morn. Constance Markovich was the president of Come in the Morn.
There's a thirst there for a different kind of politics, a different kind of militancy, a different kind of organisation. You also get it in secret groups like the Irish Republican Brotherhood, which are overhauled. And by 1912, a younger generation of Fenians, of Republicans, of secret oath-bound Republicans have taken control of the Irish Republican Brotherhood. They're not remotely interested in parliamentary politics, in constitutionalism, in Redmond and the Irish Parliamentary Party.
We've heard very little of the Irish parliamentarians during this period, of the dominant party, John Redmond's Irish Parliamentary Party, or Arthur Griffith's Sinn Féin. In reality, Redmond and Griffith came from the Catholic middle classes and did not support the workers or Larkin. Redmond's colleague, John Dillon, had this to say about the two protagonists of the lockout.
Murphy is a desperate character. Larkin is as bad. It would be a blessing for Ireland if they exterminated each other.
Both John Redmond and Arthur Griffith think Larkinism is a distraction from what they see as the real prize, Home Rule. And in 1914, with the Home Rule Act, that prize seems just around the corner. They believe the class issues being raised by Larkin and Connolly are irrelevant, and Griffith's own views on Larkin echo those of Murphy.
The consequences of Larkinism are workless fathers, mourning mothers, hungry children, and broken homes. Not the capitalist, but the policy of Larkin has raised the price of food until the poorest in Dublin are in a state of semi-famine. The curses of women are being poured on this man's head.
Redmond tended to dismiss those individuals as blackguards, but that was very much a misreading again of the forces that were at work at that time. So there is a degree, I think, of distance between Redmond and those various movements. There's a certain misunderstanding, or I think an incomprehension. That generation of Irish Parliamentary Party politicians, they just don't understand how to respond. Where are they coming from? What are their backgrounds? Look at the stark contrast between the background of someone like John Redmond on the backgrounds of Jim Larkin and James Connolly. These are leaders who emerge from dire poverty, and they come to lead many who are experiencing poverty. So that is a very changed form of political leadership and political representation, and it's very much rooted in the notion of class.
Class and gender. It's important to understand the limits of democracy in 1914 and how few people can vote. Suffrage, after all, is not just an issue for women. To vote, you need to have property, money, or be paying rent over 5 shillings a week. Redmond himself is deeply opposed to giving women the vote.
They were of an Ireland that had a very limited suffrage. Only 700,000 adult males could vote prior to 1918. So in some respects, they are living in quite a bubble. Because one of the fascinating aspects in the early 20th century in Ireland is the emergence of the female voice. And again, this is an Irish version of what's going on internationally. It's not just about suffrage. It's also about the increasing visibility and education of women and the idea of them having a role in public life generally. And what you're getting within the labour movement is another manifestation of that. The Irish Women's Workers' Union, as it emerges, for example, in some respects is challenging the male trade union establishment. And some of them are very uncomfortable with it. And they're not sure whether issues around suffrage should be linked to the question of labour. And can you compartmentalise these various issues? There's an awful lot of different layers to the labour movement, just as there are to the nationalist movement, or indeed the unionist movement. And underlining an awful lot of them is this fundamental question of class.
But if class is the fault line between Redmond and Larkin, for someone like Constance Markovich, who has literally shifted class and national loyalties, the issue of women's suffrage becomes intrinsically linked to both nationalism and socialism.
Tommy Moore, the popular poet of his day and also many days later, has set Ireland a very low idea of woman to worship. To him, woman is merely sex and an excuse for a drink, not a companion or a friend, but a beautiful houri, holding dominion by her careful manipulation of her sex and her good looks. The better ideal for a woman who, whether they like it or not, are living in a workaday world would be, if you want to walk around Ireland or any other country, dress suitably in short skirts and strong boots, leave your jewels and gold wands in the bank, and buy a revolver. Don't trust your feminine charm and your capacity for getting on the soft side of men, but take up your responsibilities and be prepared to go your own way, depending for safety on your own courage, your own truth, and your own common sense, and not on the problematic chivalry of men you may meet on the way.
Armed for the battle, kneel we before thee. Bless thou our banners, God of the brave. Ireland is living, shout we exultant. Ireland is waking, hands grasp the sword. Who fights for Ireland, God guide his blows home. Who dies for Ireland, God give him peace. Knowing our cause just, march we triumphant, living or dying, Ireland to free.
That's the battle hymn for the Irish Citizens' Army, written by Constance Markovich. And from March 1914, after the workers' defeat, Markovich takes centre stage in the Irish Citizens' Army, speaking on national recruitment rallies with Larkin and Jack White. Historian Lauren Arrington at the University of Liverpool is writing a new biography of Constance.
England is breaking, shout we exultant. England is beaten, Ireland is free.
Well, one of the things that happens, which I think is actually one of the most clever and interesting things that she does, is use her language very flexibly. So when she's speaking on the platform with, say, as representative of the ICA, we have her talk about comradeship. When she speaks to female audiences, we have her draw attention to herself as a woman. So she very much knows her audience in this way. And that's really an attempt in order to get everybody on side.
Sean O'Casey is now Secretary of the Irish Citizens Army, and he's deeply hostile to Constance Markovich. Here's how he describes her in Liberty Hall.
And Countess Markovich, running around everywhere, would be scintillating in the suit of a harlequin, lozenged with purple, old gold and virgin green.
Sean O'Casey actually moves to have Constance Markovich expelled from the Irish Citizens Army because of her involvement in Cumann na Mban, which he sees as allied to Owen McNeill's Irish Volunteers. Lauren Arrington believes O'Casey resented Constance's accent, class and behaviour, but he equally resented that she, and later Connolly, ally socialism to the nationalist cause.
It stems very much to his problem with Connolly, which is that he believes that socialism has been neglected in favour of a national campaign. And he also has a lot of class resentments penned against Markovich's background.
Markovich certainly has many critics, including the author Ruth Dudley Edwards, who gave this lecture on her for RTÉ Radio a few years ago.
She was a snob, a fraud, an exhibitionist, a murderer. She neglected her own child but trained other people's children to kill and die for Ireland. She was certainly a beauty, but boy, was she terrible.
But in many ways, that judgment of Markovich comes post-1916, and we'll explore it more in our next episode. Her title as Countess is certainly false. People like Helena Maloney, colleagues in the Citizens' Army, always called her Madam and not Countess. And here's Selina Maloney's account from her written statement after Seana Fualan's book reinforces O'Casey's line on Markievicz.
Madam Markievicz is in great danger of being misunderstood. The only account written of her is by Seana Fualan, a very bad, inaccurate, misleading and unsympathetic account of her. It completely misrepresents her character. In his book, Seana Fualan attributed vanity to Madam Markievicz as the motive of her nationalist and military activities and stressed her fondness for showy uniforms. The truth was, she had never bought a uniform, like many other members of the Citizen Army, except a Boy Scout's shirt, which then cost 3 and 6, and a Boy Scout's hat. He also stated that she would not do any work unless it brought her into the limelight. As a matter of fact, she was ready to do any sort of work that came her way, no matter how uninteresting or how menial or obscure.
There's no doubt that she's aware that her family connections and her class afford her more privileges than working women. But she uses that in order to be an advocate on their behalf. For example, two women called Annie Kavanagh and Kathleen Sheffield, who were locked out of Jacob's biscuit factory, were accused of attacking scab laborers, the women who'd taken their place at the factory. Markievicz took the stand and gave a testimony in which he said that Kavanagh and Sheffield were with her at the time at Liberty Hall, which appears to be a complete fabrication. The judge says, because he's aware of Markievicz's class background, right, he's aware of her importance in social circles, he says he didn't disbelieve the testimony of the Countess Markievicz and other ladies, but it was possible that they were mistaken as to the time. And we see this happen frequently when Markievicz takes the stand. She lies. She says she saw nothing or she heard nothing. The judge is unwilling to call her a liar. Actually, she achieves quite a lot in that awareness of coming from this place of privilege.
Lauren Arrington there. Now, internationally, Europe is politically tense post the Balkan War. And in Ireland, with home rule imminent, Edward Carson's Ulster Volunteers are arming and preparing to take action. Irish unionists are being forced to take sides. And these tensions are evident in what is now known as the Curra Mutiny in March 1914, when the British Army, led by Unionist officers like Hubert Gough, declare they are not prepared to fight the Ulster Volunteers.
And that phrase, Ulster Unionist, is very important because unionism before that really is an Irish unionism. It's about trying to keep the whole of Ireland under the Union, to maintain the Union with Britain and Ireland. But what becomes more apparent is that the focus is now going to be on Ulster, the Ulster crisis, the Ulster problem, and the development of a specifically Ulster unionism. And Southern unionists, in many respects, are left and abandoned. So it becomes a dilemma then for the British political establishment about how they are going to read what's going on in Ireland, react to what's going on in Ireland. Are they going to intervene? What do the politics of brinkmanship, for example, mean in terms of the British political party's relationship with the Irish political parties? So there's a lot of tension around all of that. Britain, to some extent, is quite lenient and quite tolerant when it comes to what they're prepared to tolerate in Ireland. You do have, in effect, free assembly. You do have a mostly uncensored press. And then by 1913, you have the situation where there are two armies drilling quite openly in both parts of the island of Ireland. So that raises all sorts of questions about the degree to which the British political establishment was either capable or willing of intervention.
Dermot Ferriter. In April, the Ulster Volunteers successfully bring in guns at Larne. By July, Irish nationalists land guns via the Asgard at Howth. Markievicz is there with the Citizens' Army. At Clontarf, the Volunteers and Fianna Éireann are intercepted by soldiers from the Scottish Borderers Regiment, but the guns are smuggled away. Later in the city, a crowd taunts the soldiers. A shot is fired, a volley follows, and four are killed, a woman and three men, and over 30 injured.
When they landed the arms at Howth, a lot of those were tenement people. These were Larkin's people, O'Yee Connolly's people. And they'd gone out to Howth with members of the Fianna Éireann and the Irish Volunteers and the whole lot. But when they were coming back, they were encountered by the police and by the military. The Citizen Army men weren't afraid of the police because they were under the cosh of the police. And so they were used to getting beaten up by the police. And that's why they began to arm themselves, carry hurley sticks. And like Larkin said, there's no point in letting the police beat you up without defending yourselves.
Terry Fagan from the North Inner City Folklore Project there. Bachelor's Walk certainly drives people to both the volunteers and the Citizens' Army. As Terry Fagan says, men and women in the tenements who have lived through the lockout turn to the Citizens' Army. The volunteers, though, are more middle class. When war breaks out in Europe with the assassination in June of the Crown Prince Franz Ferdinand, the rift between the two sides deepens. Both Comme in the Morn and the Citizens' Army run anti-recruitment rallies while John Redmond orders the Irish volunteers to join the British Army and fight. And many thousands do. The prize of home rule must wait, he says.
They have no control after 1914 over home rule. They cannot be seen to ultimately deliver on home rule because it is parked effectively for the duration of the First World War. Nobody has any idea in 1914 how long this conflict is going to last. Nobody has any idea that 35,000 Irish people are going to be killed as people who are fighting with the British Army. So there's no concept at that stage in 1914 about how long this might go on. And there were those within nationalism who believed, and within the Irish Parliamentary Party, who believed that Redmond's strategy of advocating support for the British war effort would ultimately be in the interests of Home Rule. It would make Home Rule more likely. It would make Britain more well-disposed towards overcoming Ulster resistance at the end of the war to implement Home Rule, because Redmond had shown himself to be loyal to the British Empire, and the many volunteers who became involved in the British Army, Irish volunteers who became involved in the British Army, had shown themselves to be loyal. So that this was a clever political strategy from Redmond's point of view. There are many who still today would maintain that that was the right thing to do and that that was the noble thing to do. There were many reasons why people would have enlisted in the British Army. They weren't just ideological reasons. It wasn't just about little Catholic Belgium. It wasn't just about ultimately proving that we could be loyal members of the British Empire who deserved home rule. It was also an economic consideration for many, that this was an attractive prospect economically. There was a separation allowance, for example, for those who were left behind. There were also many young people who were seeking not just employment, but excitement. All of these different factors that are always relevant to people enlisting in conflicts. The difficulty over the course of that war, for Redmond in particular, is that he no longer has any control of home rule, of the fate of Home Rule. There are so many different complicating factors in the years 1914 to 1918 that by the end of the war, Home Rule as a political project is effectively killed. So the question for not just Redmond, but of course for British politicians, is how they are going to manage a completely changed landscape at the end of the First World War.
London came an Irish man one day. As the streets are paved with gold, sure everyone was gay, singing songs of Piccadilly, Strand and Leicester Square, till Paddy got excited. Then he shouted to them there, "It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way."
On August the 4th, Britain declares war on Germany. Germany has invaded Belgium and is already at war with both Russia and France. As Dermot Ferreter says, no one could have predicted it would last until 1918 and account for some 16 million lives, both military and civilian, and another 22 million injured. As part of the British Empire, Ireland is at war, and some 200,000 Irish people join the British Army and fight. They come from all classes. Some, as Dermot says, join for the adventure, but many, as Mary Daly says, join to make a living.
Some others will probably join the army as an outlet, as a way of giving a decent livelihood to your family, because the separation allowances certainly did that.
By late August, a whole group of transport union men join the Dublin Fusiliers en masse and are known as the Dockers Company. Others who are working in businesses like Guinness's and Jacobs are encouraged and rewarded for joining. Lady Gregory's son, the cricket player and artist Robert Gregory, joins alongside the Irish parliamentarian and poet Thomas Kettle. They both join believing it is the right thing to do. Both die. Lady Gregory, in her grief, asks her friend W.B. Yeats to write a poem in his honour.
I know that I shall meet my fate somewhere among the clouds above. Those that I fight, I do not hate. Those that I guard, I do not love. My country is Kiltartan cross. My countrymen, Kiltartan's poor. No likely end could bring them loss, or leave them happier than before. Nor law nor duty bade me fight, nor public men nor cheering crowds. A lonely impulse of delight drove to this tumult in the clouds. I balanced all, brought all to mind. The years to come seemed waste of breath, a waste of breath the years behind, in balance with this life, this death.
By August 26th, the Irish Transport Union is marking the first anniversary of the lockout and using the war to its advantage. Outside Liberty Hall, a banner hangs. We serve neither King nor Kaiser, but Ireland. While James Connolly in February had written bitterly of an isolated Dublin, by now he has reframed the workers' defeat into what he's calling a draw.
From the effects of this drawn battle, both sides are still bearing scars. How deep these scars are, none will reveal.
And speaking at an event to honour the dead of the lockout, including young Alice Brady, he revises 1913 as a prequel to a Republican revolution.
The Irish Transport and General Workers' Union and the hopes of the Irish working class and that class itself stands erect and resolute, fearing no man, and the British government is down on its knees praying for the Russians to come and save them. Our fight of last year was not for added wages and reduction of hours. It was for an opportunity of building up in our midst men and women a chance to develop nobility and grandeur of character for men and women, a time to realise the nobility of life, to study the history of Ireland, to study our rights as well as our duties, time to develop men and women for the coming crisis so that they might take advantage of it when it came. These men have sold you. Sold you? No, by God, given you away. Whether my speech is pro-German or pro-Irish, I don't know. As an Irish worker, I owe a duty to our class, counting no allegiance to the Empire. I'd be glad to see it back in the bottomless pit. The Irish workers hold themselves ready to bargain with whoever can make a bargain. England has been fighting Germany. If it were not for the Russians, French and Japanese, the British would not have made a mouthful for the Germans. If you're itching for a rifle, itching to fight, better to fight for our own country than for the robber empire. If ever you shoulder a rifle, let it be for Ireland. Conscription or no conscription, they will never get me or mine. You've been told you're not strong, that you have no rifles. Revolutions do not start with rifles. Start first and get your rifles after. Our curse is our belief in our weakness. We are not weak, we are strong. Make up your mind to strike before your opportunity goes.
The spirit of freedom floats in the ether. Souls of our heroes march by our side. Tone is our battle cry, Emmet inspires us. Though who for freedom fall never shall die.
By now, Connolly is focusing his attention on the Citizens' Army and the opportunity the war brings to gain Irish independence.
And I suspect that James Connolly came to that conclusion, that there was going to be no opportunity for a Labour programme or a trade union programme to be implemented unless this question of the constitutional status of Ireland was sorted out, that ultimately you would just have a continuation of what happened in 1913 as long as this bigger question remained unresolved. So it's an acceptance on the part of James Connolly that this is the bigger question in the short term. So that would have been the product of a great degree of soul-searching on his part. It would have also been as a result of him being influenced by other individuals. And don't underestimate, I suppose, the power of what's there culturally and politically and what's being published and what's been spoken about in the years 1913 to 1914 and 1915.
By November, Jim Larkin leaves for the United States, leaving Connolly in charge of both the Transport Union and the Citizens' Army.
He took over the union as acting general secretary in 1914. By 1916, the membership had fallen to about 3,500 to 5,000. We don't really know because there were no proper records. Connolly was a poor organiser, was totally preoccupied by then by the Citizen Army and planning the rising, which is understandable in a way, and neglected the day job and was lucky not to get sacked, and the union were lucky not to sack him.
Poor Gates there. Larkin will not return to Ireland until 1923. By then, everything is utterly changed. The Easter Rising, a war of independence, and a civil war have shaped the land. While Connolly had been his lieutenant in the lockout, it's Connolly who now takes decisions which will, for good or bad, shape modern Ireland. In one of his last speeches in Dublin, Larkin addresses the rising sectarian divide in Ireland, a divide which will dominate the coming age, perhaps even more than class.
The question of religion was a matter for each individual's conscience, and in a great many cases was the outcome of birth or residence in a certain geographical area. Claiming for ourselves liberty of conscience, liberty to worship, we shall see to it that every other individual enjoys the same right. Intolerance has been the curse of our country. It is for us to preach the gospel of tolerance and comradeship for all men and women. There must be freedom for all to live, to think, to worship. No book, no avenue must be closed.
In our next episode, we're exploring the consequences of the lockout, the road to 1916, and the faith of our protagonists, James Connolly, Constance Markovich, William Martin Murphy, and Jim Larkin, as well, of course, as the citizens of Dublin.
I personally thank God that I have lived to see the day when thousands of Irish men and boys and hundreds of Irish women and girls were ready to affirm that truth and to attest it with their lives if need be.